Early this summer, a minor news item appeared. Coach Ryan Day, football coach of the 2025 National Championship Ohio State Buckeyes, was reported to be on a cruise ship. They got stranded out at sea due to mechanical problems and was 3 days delayed arriving at its final destination. Now, that's if you believe the news reports and lack insider information, but as it turns out, I have insider information. And I'm going to let you in on the real story. Just remember, you heard it here first. It all started back in January after Ohio State won the national championship in football. Much to his consternation, Ryan Day had a severe flare-up of insomnia, a total inability to sleep. This wasn't the first time. He'd had it 4 times before. At the end of each November from 2021 through 2024, after losing to Michigan in the last game of the regular season. It was severe enough that he sought treatment at the Ohio State Medical Center, but treatment was only minimally successful. In fact, this last November, an OSU doctor joked that the only real cure for his insomnia was either, and I quote, to beat Michigan or to win the national championship. Coach Day suspected the doctor was not really joking. Well, he had not beaten Michigan, but he did go on to win the national championship. But instead of a cure, the insomnia struck him even worse than ever. And the doctors were no help, telling him there was nothing they could do. But then an unpaid graduate assistant in the athletic department, who just happened to be a Michigan grad, was overheard saying, "If only the coach were in Ann Arbor, there is an amazing doctor who could cure his insomnia." Which is how it came to be that a disguised Ryan Day, his just-for-men-only black beard dyed an aging gray, and wearing a Detroit Tiger baseball cap pulled down over its eyes, sat in a University of Michigan hospital examination room, waiting to see this world-renowned insomnia specialist. The knock came on the door opened, but it wasn't a world-renowned insomnia specialist. It was only a fresh-faced medical resident who didn't even introduce himself, but just handed him a slip of paper saying, "The doctor will not be able to see you personally today. Here's your treatment regimen," and immediately left. Taken aback, he looked at the paper, and it said this: "Go to the big house. Shower 7 times in the home team locker room, each time singing Hail to the Victors at the top of your lungs, and you will be cured." Well, the only thing that came to mind was a line from The Princess Bride: "Inconceivable." Coach Day stormed out of the examination room. He went down the hall and into the elevators. When he got to the lobby, he stormed outside and stood on the sidewalk, fuming, feeling the return of the chest pains and anxiety which accompanied his insomnia. When his assistants caught up with him, he said to them, "I just won the national championship in football. I am the football coach of the Ohio State University. I thought that for me, she would surely come in and call upon her medical expertise and give me a pill or a treatment regimen to cure me. Are not the Ohio State locker room showers bigger and better than those at the big house? And is not Battle Cry, the Ohio State fight song, a far greater fight song than Hail to the Victors?" And in a most vexatious snip, he demanded his assistants drive him back to Columbus. But his assistant stopped him before driving away and said, If the doctor had prescribed you a painful regimen of treatment, say a habanero pepper nasal flush or a murder hornet poultice, would you not have done it? All she asks is you take 7 showers and sing a silly song 7 times. How hard is that? And so Ryan Day snuck into the big house, showered 7 times while singing Hail to the Victors at the top of his lungs, and then he drove back to Columbus, where that night and every night since, he sleeps like a baby. Now, in case you hadn't figured it out, I made that story up. You probably also made the connection that I was retelling in modern form the 2 Kings 5 story of the cure of Naaman, the Aramean general. Now, I imagine that they loved this story in old Israel. Israel was proud of itself. Most peoples are. But down deep, the Israelites knew that they were just small potatoes in the vegetable patch of the ancient Middle East. And so the story of Naaman, general extraordinaire of the country of Aram, was a story affirming that Israel had something that even the rich and famous and foreign coveted. They had a prophet with a pipeline to God who heals when no one else could. And the story unfolds in a most satisfying way. A successful general of a foreign country is stymied by a deadly disease from which his armies cannot save him. The least among the children of Israel, a small girl taken captive and made a slave, clues in the general that there may be a cure if the proper prophet is found. Naaman and the king take the route of power. They send a formal letter with presents to Israel's king, expecting arrangements for a cure. But the corridors of power are shaken. The king of Israel smells a trap if he doesn't deliver a cure. And he doesn't even think of Elisha, as the little girl did. Then prophet Elisha sends a note to the king of Israel. Yo, king, take a chill pill. Send the dude my way. And when Naaman arrives, Elisha doesn't even come outside to look him over. He sends a messenger to prescribe a treatment, and perhaps thinking, see, I think the prophets were closet comedians. I know Elijah was. I suspect Elisha was too. So I guess that Elijah thought about some of the disgusting stuff he'd seen floating down the Jordan River. And he probably snickered while he said, yo, general, go wash 7 times in the Jordan. And Naaman's sizable, success-swollen ego takes a whack. Moi? I am a success. I am head of the armies of Aram. I expected this prophet to come out, tell his God how important and successful I am, wave his hand, so I would be cured. Instead, he tells me to bathe in that muddy little sewer, the Jordan. If I have to wash in the river, let it be a proper river, a river fit for a general like the Abana or the Pharpar. And for his egotism, Naaman almost misses the cure. Only the intervention of his servants makes him see sense. And so he washes 7 times in the Jordan. His skin disease disappears. Now, on one level, this story is about a struggle between worldly powers and Israel's power from God. We kind of know who's going to win. After all, Israel is the one telling this story. Israel's way is vindicated. God wins. The covenant with Abraham notches another bit of validating evidence. Through Israel will the nations of the earth be blessed. But there's another aspect to this story that is, at least I found, even more satisfying. Yeah, God triumphs through his prophet Elisha. No surprise there. But this is the question. Who are the heroes of the story? Now forget about Elisha and Yahweh, God. It's a given. And frankly, Elisha and God barely show up in this story. At least they don't do much. God only gets mentioned in the beginning as arranging Naaman's military success, and then as an identifier for Elisha as a prophet or man of God. God doesn't do anything that we are told. And Elisha, for his part, doesn't budge from his rocking chair. He does nothing more than send out messengers with instructions. As Naaman himself pointed out, Elisha didn't even so much as wave his hand over Naaman's leprosy. So who are the real heroes? Certainly not Naaman, the petulant power broker. Not the king of Aram, and certainly not the king of Israel, who pretty much wets himself when he gets the letter from Aram's king. No, the heroes? A nameless Israelite servant girl, a slave, torn from home, who returns good for evil. And Naaman's nameless servants, who face the general's rage to talk sense into him. A rage, we might note, that sends the king of Israel into heart palpitations, but which the servants risk to talk sense into him when success has gone to his head. I want to reflect on that for a moment. The unnamed ones, the anonymous ones, the generic ones, slave girl, servants. And it almost makes you think that you and I, who in all likelihood would end up in a nameless role in a story like this, it almost makes you think that people like you and I are capable of heroic action as well. So let me ask you, do you find yourself wondering if your name will live past you, will somehow register to history? I have a confession to make. I do. Sometimes. Not often. I mean, this isn't an obsession or anything like this, but, you know, you go in a public building, and the public building has a name on it. The such-and-such federal building, or the such-and-such courthouse. And you think, wow, that person got a building named after him. They must have been somebody important. Or you're driving down the highway, and you notice a sign saying that this highway is named after someone. And it might occur to you, this may be a soldier or a police officer who gave their life in the line of duty. And they've named the highway after them, so their name will live on. Or you're walking through a park, and a bench has a plaque on it dedicating that bench to the memory of somebody. How many of us will get even a park bench, much less a highway or a building or anything else, named in our memory? And those words of the Apostle Paul come to mind. Not many of you were wise by human standards. Not many were powerful. Not many were of noble birth. Yeah, that's me. Yeah, that's me the Bible's talking about. That's us. But God chose the foolish, the weak, the ones whose names will disappear into the blur of history. God chose the slave girl and the nameless servants. As a reminder that we are not here first and foremost to make a name for ourselves, And many of us will succeed at that. But the beauty of our lives is entirely consistent with anonymity, with heroic anonymity, with remaining nameless in the story. In Judaism, there is an expression that sums up the task given to humans by God. In Hebrew, the expression is tikkun olam. It means repairing the world. In a created world of stunning beauty and overflowing good, there are still many broken things and broken people, deep wounds that are in need of repair and healing. And you know, it's not about us. It's about seeing the wounds and caring enough to want to repair the world. And you don't need a famous name to participate in world repair. And so the young Israeli slave girl who spoke up, she was repairing the world. Setting ego aside and self-interest, she spoke a word that ultimately brought healing. The general servants also repairing the world at some risk to themselves. Setting ego aside and self-interest, they spoke a word that ultimately led to healing. Heroic, anonymous, beautiful. Maybe we should imagine it this way. Some years ago, my wife and I spent a week on the island of Iona, which is a small island off the west coast of Scotland. Iona is considered to be a thin place where earth and heaven come close together. It's a place where Christianity first came to Scotland, brought there by the Irish monk Columba back in 563 AD, 1500 years ago. And Columba and his companions established a monastery on Iona, one which flourished until the monasteries were abolished in the English Reformation. But the monastery was then rebuilt after World War I as a project of the Iona community, and it now serves as a spiritual retreat center. Now, during our week there, the retreat sponsored various activities each day. And one day was devoted to a pilgrimage around the island. The island is only 5 miles long and 1.5 miles wide. And the pilgrimage stopped at various places with historical and religious significance, and we'd engage in prayer and song and reflection. One of the first places we stopped was the ruins of the Iona Nunnery, a convent for women, which had been the companion community for women to Iona Abbey, which was for the men. The nunnery had fallen into ruin too, but unlike the monastery, had not been rebuilt. So it was only ruins. Our guide that day was a young woman from Eastern Europe, and she told us just a little bit about the nunnery. Because you see, there wasn't much to tell, it turns out, because very little was known of the women who lived there. Over hundreds of years of existence, and among hundreds of women who took holy orders and lived out their lives there, the names of only two survived. One abbess gets historical mention, and one woman's first name appears on a headstone. That's it. And our guide reminded us of the anonymity of women throughout much of history. This was personal for her. She had just graduated from seminary back in her home country, and was standing for ordination in her religious community back home. And just as she was on the verge of taking her first pastoral call to a church, her denomination backtracked and ruled that women would not be allowed to serve as ministers. And she had just received word that they had voted against it, and a door had closed on her future, telling her that she was to stay anonymous and invisible. She asked us to look at the nunnery walls that still stood. And she pointed out, you know, the stones are what you notice first. The stones are solid. They're impressive. They're not beautiful, but impressive. But then your eye moves from the impressive to the beautiful. Tiny flowers that grow and flourish in the cracks between the stones. Beautiful, tiny flowers that manage to find a toehold on the edges and flourish despite the harsh conditions. There's a picture, unfortunately in black and white, in your bulletin, right below the listing for the sermon, a picture of the stones and flowers. And she pointed out that the stones were the important people, the names that make their mark in history and on which history seems to be built. They get the buildings named after them. They get the highways. They get the park benches. But she said, the beauty, the grace, the world's healing lies somewhere else. It lies in the edges. It lies on the margins, in the flowers, in the cracks, in the anonymous heroes of everyday life. The world repairs. And so let me leave you with a question. Would you rather make a name for yourself, or would you rather display the beauty of heroic anonymity?